There is an appointed time for everything, and a time for every affair under the heavens. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to uproot the plant. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to seek, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away.
A time to keep. The words are from the third chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes, and they're old beyond the tracing. But in the year 1963, on a solemn November Monday, they would be summoned back. There is an appointed time for everything under the sun. And for all of us, for the young and old, whatever our station or our goals, 1963 was a year to remember, a time to keep.
When it began, there was the usual rattling and thumping of ordinary things happening in ordinary ways. On New Year's Day, Southern California beat Wisconsin 42-37, which was nice for Southern California, but not terribly startling. On January 2nd, Fidel Castro gave us another exercise in the modern art form, talk fact. That is, say something is a fact because you wish it were. He said the imperialists, meaning us, of course, had been defeated all over Latin America. So not much was new. But soon we heard something that was a new voice, one many Americans did not want to hear, but it could not be escaped. It was the voice of the American Negro demanding a better deal. The Negro was no longer somewhere on the other side of town. He was at the front door and tired of knocking.
We've waited 100 years, and we are not waiting another day. We want all of it now! We want every privilege. We want every benefit. We want every right. We want every opportunity. And we want it now!
We want it now. It was a phrase we would hear again and again in 1963. Now, now, as though all their yesterdays were debts long overdue, and tomorrow would be too late.
The Negro tide rose like the rising of a tide on a beach, quietly and subtly in some places, noisily and violently in others. Birmingham, Alabama was one of these. It began on April 2nd, a giant complaint about segregation at lunch counters, public facilities, and in jobs. Within 3 weeks, more than 400 Negroes had been arrested, water hoses had been used against them, and dogs, but the demonstrators were aroused and would not be stopped.
The spark that was struck in Birmingham crackled like a brush fire across the South.
And what began in the South then spread northward to the big cities of the East and Midwest. Pickets held up construction work in New York until promises were made that more Negroes would be hired. Chicago heard them demanding better schools and housing. By midsummer, we knew this was not just another protest, but a revolution, a curious revolution, and curious because it was reluctant and restrained. There were violent moments, but mainly its philosophy was taken from the Negro Protestant Church, and what in other countries and at other times would have been a call to bloodshed became, in this case, a sermon. This is Cambridge, Maryland, summer 1963.
In the midst of moral injustices, yes. Lord, help us to say, Lord, thy will be done.
Amen.
And help us to love as we never loved before. Lord, as we walk in thy will, hear us from on high.
Yes, sir.
Stir up the city of Cambridge.
Yes,
and put thy love in the hearts of our white brothers and sisters.
Jackson, Mississippi, and Albany, Georgia, Baltimore, Nashville, Raleigh. On June 11th, two Negro students were enrolled at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, Vivian Juanita Malone and James Alexander Hood. Both were 20. Alabama's Governor George C. Wallace made his promised gesture of defiance, standing in the schoolhouse door as the nation watched on television and the two students appeared for their enrollment. While an official of the Justice Department fidgeted uneasily, Wallace read his legal pronouncement.
Now, therefore, I, George C. Wallace, as governor of the state of Alabama, have by my action raised issues between the central government and the sovereign state of Alabama, which said issues should be adjudicated in the manner prescribed by the Constitution of the United States, and now being mindful of my duties and responsibilities under the Constitution of the United States.
June 11th, and the day ended as it began, with legalistic words being read in a legalistic way, and a boy and a girl giving stereotyped answers to stereotyped questions, and a deputy attorney general who seemed slightly embarrassed by what he was doing. Well, somehow it seemed unreal, but it was terribly real. Midnight came, and with it, a quietness on the campus at Tuscaloosa. But at that moment, 180 miles to the southwest, across the Mississippi state line in Jackson, Medgar Evers, a field director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, drove home from an integration rally. He was 37, a college graduate, married, father of two sons and a daughter. He stepped out of his car. He was shot and killed. Now, there was more to come. Birmingham again. On the morning of September 15th, a Sunday, the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed. Four Negro girls listening to a Sunday school lesson were killed. The lesson was called The Love That Forgives.
Newsmen walking the streets of Birmingham noted a tenseness, a strained self-consciousness between the whites and Negroes. Some wrote phrases like fear gripping the city. There were such moments, of course, in Birmingham and in other cities and towns. But what is more significant is that in most places there was neither the fear nor the compulsion toward violence that most revolutions feed on. In fact, in many places, north and south, changes did come subtly and silently. Not everything the Negroes had demanded, but some, and it was now.
What are we marching for? How long are we going to march?
All right.
If there is a sound that was characteristic of that year, it would be the sound of footsteps, of thousands of men and women and children walking on endless errands. Walking not to move from one place to another, but to be seen, to be heard, to have their desires made manifest and public. And in the heat of summer, in August, that angry month when the French Revolution snarled and burned its way through Paris streets, there was a new and exultant chapter written in the history of Western thought.
It began early in the morning of Wednesday, August 28th. More than 200,000 people, mostly Negroes, but many whites, gathered on the long slope below the Washington Monument in the nation's capital. They carried signs saying, an end to bias, decent housing, an end to police brutality, and each of them punctuated with the word now. Some of the leaders met with members of Congress and the president, but it was the ordinary people who gave the day its strange power and dignity. Slowly, quietly, the huge crowd walked a mile to the Lincoln Memorial. The police were there, plus National Guardsmen and Army reservists, 5,000 in all, and the Army was ready nearby, but the marchers caused less trouble than a crowd leaving a night ball game. The ceremonies at the memorial were, in a sense, almost anticlimactic. The Reverend Martin Luther King aroused the crowd with words that all of them wanted said.
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual.
Dr. King's words really were aimed across town at Capitol Hill. There, 2 months earlier, the president had delivered a civil rights bill to Congress. As he did, he spelled out, as no other president ever had, exactly what the issue was.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? Legislation, I repeat, cannot solve this problem alone. It must be solved in the homes of every American, in every community across our country.
But even when some things change, most things don't. And 1963, in most ways, was like any other year. Somewhere, a panel of middle-aged judges chose a beauty queen, put a rhinestone crown on her head, and she burst into tears and embraced the girl who came in second. Several politicians claimed they were misquoted, that they didn't really say that, but they did. Somewhere, a little boy got his head caught in something and the fire department got it out. And surely, somewhere, the newspapers reported a man named Washington was caught telling a lie in traffic court. The quintuplets were in this year. There were 2 sets, 5 boys in Venezuela. Their mother was 34 and already a grandmother. A week later, another set in Aberdeen, South Dakota, born to Mrs. Mary Ann Fisher. The Census Bureau said, at 20 seconds after 10:59 in the morning of September 27th, Eastern Daylight Time, the population of the United States hit 190 million, including the Fisher quintuplets.
And of those 190 million, 55,912 crowded into Los Angeles Chavez Ravine on the afternoon of October 6th to watch the home team meet the New York Yankees in the 4th game of the World Series. The Dodgers had taken the first 3 games, with 2 away in the last half of the 9th. Dodgers leading 2-1, Koufax pitching. There was one more tense moment.
Nelson Howard, the batter, with 2 out of the 9th inning. He swings a ground ball to deep shortstop. Murray Wills throws to second. It's all. Wait a minute. He dropped the ball. He had it. Called him out. And then the ball was dropped. Howard is safe at first base. Bobby Richardson is safe at second. And now it's all between Koufax and Hector Lopez. It's a tap back past the mound to Murray Wills. He grabs it, throw to first. It's all over. The Dodgers win it. The final score, the Dodgers 2 and the Yankees 1. Well, the Los Angeles Dodgers are the world's champions of baseball as they have swept the 1963 World Series in 4 straight games.
Nobody counted, but there did seem to be a few more beards being worn than there had been in past years, and they were perhaps a little more neatly trimmed than in 62. The pizza became upper middle class and fashionable. The stock market was generally up and steady. Necklines were down and unsteady.
It was also a year of sudden and violent deaths. Disaster is no stranger to the pages of history. But in 1963, it seemed to strike with more viciousness and versatility than usual. On April 10th, in the waters of the Atlantic, 220 miles east of Cape Cod, the USS Thresher, a nuclear-powered submarine, failed to surface after a dive. 129 officers, men, and civilian technicians perished. And in the early morning of July 26th, the city of Skopje in Yugoslavia was shaken by the first tremors of a devastating earthquake. When it was over, some 2,000 persons had been killed. On October 4th, a hurricane went wild in the Caribbean for 4 days and left at least 6,000 dead in Haiti and Cuba. A dam spilled over above the Italian alpine town of Longroni, wiping out 1,800 persons, 80% of the population. And on August 13th, a coal mine accident near Hazleton, Pennsylvania, trapped 3 men 300 feet underground. 2 of the men were saved in a dramatic 14-day rescue operation that caught the attention of the world. Our microphone was present when miner Henry Throne was hoisted to the surface.
All right, I'm coming up.
Go ahead, he's coming up.
All right.
Go ahead.
I'm coming up.
Coming up.
I'm turning around the ring. Boy, what a ride this is.
You're right here, boy. Nothing but the best for you.
They have him. Henry Throne has reached the surface.
On March 22nd, John Profumo of the British Cabinet stood up in the House of Commons, looked out over the benches filled with his colleagues, and told a lie. He said, yes, he knew a girl named Christine Keeler, but only in a proper way. But the rumors ran on and on. There were stories of racy happenings beside the pool on Lord Astor's estate, and other encounters which placed Profumo, the State Secretary for War, in the same fast crowd or set with a Captain Ivanov of the Soviet Embassy and a Dr. Stephen Ward, an osteopath who always seemed to have young girls around. Well, on the 4th of June, Profumo admitted it was all a lie. His previous denial was, as he put it, not true, and I misled you, the Prime Minister, and my colleagues in the House. I have come to realize that by this deception, I have been guilty of a grave misdemeanor. Now, there were calls for Macmillan to resign. He didn't want to, and for a long time, he didn't. But in October, he went to a hospital for surgery, and then he announced, I will need a considerable period of convalescence. I would not be able to face a prolonged electoral campaign. The Earl of Hume, Foreign Secretary in the Macmillan Cabinet, renounced his peerage and became Prime Minister Sir Alec Douglas Hume. And so ended the affair Profumo. Nell Gwynn and a host of other ladies who throughout history were involved in activities that were sometimes at least quasi-political simply would not have understood.
And sometimes dramatically, sometimes subtly, the familiar world was changing. On October 15th, 5 days after Macmillan quit, West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, now 87, finally kept his long-delayed promise to resign his leadership. In a statement to the Bundestag, Der Alte made it clear that though he had stepped down, he had not stepped out.
Und meine verehrten Damen und Herren, ich werde zuhören.
Now I will return to your ranks, and I will listen. I hope to speak but little.
Ja, meine Herren, wenn Sie mich auffordern, dann werde ich sprechen, hoffentlich gut sprechen.
But if you ask me, then I will speak.
Only Charles de Gaulle, France's implacable man of destiny and dreams, remained at year's end of the big three leaders of Western Europe. And de Gaulle, early in 1963, made it clear he intended, if necessary, to go it alone after squeezing Britain out of the common market and turning down a United States offer of Polaris submarines.
Économique européenne et aussi dans celle de l'adhésion éventuelle de la Grande-Bretagne, ce sont les faits qu'il faut d'abord considérer.
In South Vietnam, already strained by a war against communist guerrillas and tense with religious and political discontent, a final convulsion. In a series of swift moves on November 1st and 2nd, the United States trained and equipped South Vietnamese armed forces, toppled the government, and deposed President Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother and chief advisor Ngo Dinh Nu, chief of the country's secret police.
In Vietnam, it is this. No coup can be can erupt without at least American incitement or American...
Madame Nu was in this country when it happened. Lovely and chic and bitter in her resentment against Americans, she spit out her answers to the newsmen who surrounded her.
Shows that there is a real lack of control or disloyalty from the American government. Lack of control or disloyalty.
Will you seek political asylum in this country if the coup is successful?
Never. No, because I cannot stay in a country.
On the first day of this year, at the traditional New Year's Day party in the Kremlin, a rumor finally became a reality, or at least got official recognition. Premier Khrushchev acknowledged that there were some differences between Russia and China, but they were, he said, of a family nature. Later, Radio Moscow was not so subtle.
China's leaders say they favor peace and peaceful coexistence. Unfortunately, their actions do not bear this out. And actions speak louder than words. During the Caribbean crisis, when the world stood on the brink of a thermonuclear disaster, China's leaders tried to fan the flames by claiming that a compromise with the United States amounted to surrendering to imperialism and reaching a Munich deal at the expense of the Cuban nation. It is significant that any move to improve relations between the Soviet Union and the United States meets with strong objections from the Chinese leaders.
And a response from Radio Pekin.
In the present situation of the international communist movement, it is advantageous from the point of view of tactics to refer to the desire for peaceful transition. But it would be inappropriate to overemphasize the possibility of peaceful transition. The proletariat and the Communist Party must be prepared at all times to repulse counter-revolutionary attacks. And at the critical juncture of the revolution, when the working class is seizing state power, to overthrow the bourgeoisie by armed force if it uses armed force to suppress the people's revolution.
On August 5th, in Moscow, the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union agreed to a treaty outlawing nuclear testing in outer space, in the atmosphere, and underwater. On September 24th, the United States Senate ratified it. And by early September, there was a direct teletype circuit called a hotline between the Kremlin and the White House for fast communication between the two centers of power. At the end of the year, it was announced West Berliners would be allowed to visit relatives in the communist sector of Germany. East German guards were photographed breaking a hole in the infamous wall for the Western visitors to walk through. It was a stirring moment in a city that has known many of them. On June 26, President Kennedy had visited West Berlin during a triumphant tour. In a confrontation with 150,000 ecstatic West Berliners, he summoned them to stand firm and meet their obligations to the future.
2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was, Civis Romanus sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
It was a strange meeting, this young man in this place. Before him were men who 19 years earlier had been shooting at Americans, and now they cheered the English words and waved American flags. And for a few moments, he stood there and listened to their voices. He would not come back.
Vor 2000 Jahren war der stolzeste Satz, den ein Mensch sagen konnte, der: Ich bin ein Bürger Roms. Heute ist der stolzeste Satz, den jemand in der freien Welt sagen kann: Ich bin ein Berliner.